So my talk will be somewhat longer than that. So previous to eight, the reason I asked for questions in the middle is because all of these talks are pretty much, these talks are often a laundry list of here's what we did and here's what we plan to do. And if people don't ask questions about what we did or what's going to be in the OS or some feature they're interested in or maybe something you don't see on the list, then this becomes me just reciting the release notes, which, fascinating as that is, I'm sure, is not exactly how we want to do this. Could I speak up a little?
Oh, no, leave out the microphone.
Are you serious?
I'm sorry. I buried that here.
Clearly. You've been asking me to shut up for years. All right, I'm going to do this. Hold on a second. Time has come to Walrus said to speak of many things. Okay, so previous E8. So now that we're doing previous E8 and currently release candidate 2 is out, and we're hoping that release candidate 2 will be the last release candidate and will become the release after some amount of reasonable testing, which means that the head of the tree for previous E is now 9.0. So for those of you who run the head of the tree or run current, if you boot a kernel and it comes out as 9.0, that's not a bug. That's actually what the tree looks like. And stable is about to be 8.0. So what I want to do is go over some of the features at different levels. A lot of people just want to hear, what did you add to the kernel? What's the new drivers? What did you do deep down inside the system? But there actually are people who use FreeBSD and who don't simply sit and tinker with the kernel. I don't personally know any of them, but they do exist. So I want to talk about features at a couple of different levels. Talk a little bit about the I'll call out some of these on slides coming out. Parallel port fills are really useful since there's far more ports than there are lines of code in the kernel. It's nice if you can build that in parallel. Some significant updates to jails for those of you who use jails, which is probably pretty much everyone in the room who uses previous day. DOM use support for Xen and better handling of hot device removal. So this means you can run it on a laptop again. So parallel port builds is a pretty obvious idea, and until recently you couldn't take advantage of the fact that you had more than one processor or more than one core when building a port. And as I said, there are far more ports than there are any other piece of code in the system. And I don't know if you've noticed, but certain ports, if you touch them, they touch everything else. Like if you view like anything in the GNOME collection, you will then rebuild everything. And so you'd like to throw more cores at that. The dependencies themselves build serially. That's not fixed yet. But the really important thing is this last line, which is users don't need to make any changes. The port system basically does this automatically. So it will build with minus J reasonable to your system. And that means if you've got a typical new Henrin box or new Hamel box and you've got a lot of cores, you're just going to use them to build ports. Ports will build a lot faster. So nice feature. I use it a lot now. Some updates to jails, most important of which, and I think, I don't know how many years people have been asking for this, but multiple IPs per jail, so you can actually do some reasonable things with some networking inside of a jail. Hierarchical jails, jails within jails, that I can't even imagine either. jails are hard enough for you to use just singly. I'm thinking hierarchical jails, my head would explode. IPv6 and SCP support, and one of the things that's been a big push in jails lately, as you can see by the multiple IPs, is getting all of the bits of the network stack to talk to it. And in a way, some of this got pushed by one of the bigger kernel features we're going to talk about, which is network virtualization. But we've updated so that other protocols that are in the stack, IPv6 being important, actually work correctly within jails. And again, a lot of the features you're going to see in FreeBSD 8, and there was a good deal of this in 7, but 8 really tries to go all out in exploiting multiple cores and multiple processors, because your typical machine has 2, 4, a laptop at this point has 2 cores. So a desktop certainly going to have a lot more. So being able to tie things to a particular CPU or a particular core and say, jail 1 is on this core, and jail 2 is on this core, and jail 3 is on this core. And that's really important, not just because it's cool that you have a lot of cores in your machine, while that is really cool. It's pretty important because if things don't bounce around on your system, and this doesn't matter if it's jails or if it's another job, the less things move between cores that are long running, the better performance you're going to get, because you're not going to lose your cache coherency. Any data that was used is still going to hopefully be in the cache. You'll definitely get better performance if you understand your workload and you tie that workload to particular cores. So for people who run a lot of jails in like a hosting situation, I can see this being a really important feature.
Yeah, so for me, also just lock down any problems with local system utilization too.
If you've got the jerk jail, then only CPU 3 is getting jerked. Yes.
Is there any plans to do anything like Solaris does, where you can actually define processor sets and set workloads, sets, and say, okay, these guys go here.
And that's in the kernel side, and I'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, cool.
And I put the user stuff first, so I would force all of you to go through it, and then we can talk about it. Because if I didn't use your stuff again, you'd all walk out and get a beer. My way of keeping you. Zen support, this is going to become more and more important. There's a couple of different ways of doing virtualization. Previously works fine under things like VMware. In particular, if I have to do something particularly dangerous, I just stick a FreeBSD in a VMware instance. But a lot of people who build the large data centers, for instance, these guys who have this book business, Amazon, if you want to be able to run FreeBSD as a guest to provide services, and Zen has been probably the hardest virtualization technology for us to adapt to because it requires a lot more of the OS than any of the other virtualization technologies. If you look at VMware or Parallels, any of these systems, they really are providing a complete machine, and Zen, until recently, made you do a lot more work. So some work's been done on that. We can run as a 32-bit guest. And the reason to do that is for these data center deployment kind of things, like being able to run on EC2 at Amazon.
And that's versus 64-bit guest? Or
only at the moment, only a 32-bit guest.
It's not there.
John Baldwin, and I'll follow up my answer, yes.
So
I'll just, you sit there and eat, and I'll do this.
There's a few different ways under Zen that you can have a guest. It can run it like VMware, where it runs in a fully emulated machine, which is kind of the fullest method you can run Zen. And FreeBSD will run in that method fine, just like any other unmodified OS. Domu is a mode where you actually make certain calls into the Zen hypervisor, the kind of the Zen operating system, to do certain things like page table updates, or different things that go much quicker than if you do it purely through the like pure
emulation
machine.
Yeah.
The 32-bit Domu support, the Domu support is only 32-bit, so for FreeBSD I have 86 at the moment. But there's kind of a hybrid approach. Part of the virtualization stuff Zen provides, part of it is you can do things like page table updates or VM system stuff quicker. Excuse me. But it also provides some kind of pseudo device drivers for things like a disk device or a network device that talks to the outside world. And there's a kind of mixed mode where we have device drivers for those special Zen devices that can run in a kind of stock 32-bit or 64-bit kernel. So you can run a 64-bit Zen, but have to be a little bit faster than the pure emulated mode by using this special hypervisor mode, HVM mode, that uses these optimized device drivers, and that gives you a lot of performance that you lose normally when you run an emulated mode. So you can do both 32 and 64-bit in that kind of mixed mode, and so you can be a little faster than the pure simulated mode that way.
But pure Domu is not 64-bit.
Yeah, pure Domu is only 32-bit.
Okay. John Baldwin, ladies and gentlemen, is also a source committer. This is why I'm going to keep doing this. Oh, hey, look, kernel features. This is part of the laundry list. Super pages, text dumps, and multiprocessor JTGY system, new USB stack, which a lot of people care about, updates to the scheduler, which is what ULE is, stack smashing protection, device and map extensions, BIP support, Linux API, updated HWPMC.
Super pages is the key.
I'm going to go through a whole bunch of these.
Super pages.
Okay, this is super pages. So it turns out that we now have enough memory in the machine that your TLB is a precious resource, because you can easily blow out the TLB with the amount of memory. If all of your pages are 4K sized and you've got, say, 24 gigs in your desktop, which is certainly possible at the moment, and you've got an awful lot of 4K pages, and if you reference them, then you're going to blow out your TLB, and TLB lookups will slow down, because when you do a TLB lookup, the thing won't be there, and so you have to go again. Yes?
What's TLB?
Translation Look-Aside Buffer. Would you like to know what it is as well, or? Just what it means. It's the easiest way to explain that is what the TLB does is it's the index into all of the page tables to find the page. So when you look up a virtual address and you're like, hey, I don't want memory that's at like, you know, 0xFFF, you know, this address, you first go to the TLB to look it up, and it's like, well, that's actually here. And so that TLB is of the limited size. It's not huge. And so if you've got things, if you've got very large data sets, then it pays to have, to store them in large pages. Because if you store them in 4 or 8K pages, that's too small. If you store them in 2 or 4 megabyte pages, then your TLB usage, you're not thrashing the TLB as much. John actually worked on the super pages stuff, and I think he's edging the... No, he's not. You look like you wanted to say something.
No, you're fine.
Okay, fair enough. So what this really is for applications that have large working sets, they can increase performance because you actually have all of this information much closer where you need it. What was that?
How is that configured?
Magic. What do you mean? Like,
do you compile with the Flex or a lot of
things? So unlike some other operating systems, you don't have to do anything to change your app to use
it. That's what I thought.
The kernel actually uses a special memory allocator that tries to group pages when you have page faults to make large pages all
right. Right. No, that part I understand. What I'm curious about is depending on the workload that your application has to go through, 4 meg page versus a 4K page. You pay a trade off there, and just because I have 24 gigs in mind, that's not, doesn't mean necessarily I want 4 megabyte pages to swap in and out, you know. If the application, if I'm running a bunch of applications, one of them uses a, it doesn't need much memory, or has this memory very fragmented, or something, but I don't necessarily want to have a very large page to potentially pull in off of this. And on the other hand, if I have something that has very large pages and can make use of that, then I would like to do so. I mean, so what I'm curious about is, in the past, the TLB was effectively just an array with a given size, you know, and that size was divided equally amongst all the slots in the array.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Is that the same now? So I make a choice for 4 megabyte or 8 megabyte pages, and now I'm stuck with that no matter what the app is trying to do?
Well, okay. So the TLB depends, how the TLB is laid out depends on the CPU. So most Opteron processors and all but the very recent Intel processors actually have the TLB kind of split into two pieces. So most of your TLB is the small pages, like 4 or 10 pages. So if you have a TLB with 512 entries, it might have, well, they have like 512 entries for 4K pages and 4 entries for large pages, either 4 meg or 2 meg pages. The newest Intel CPUs, such as the Halon, possibly Pinder, I'm not sure, actually have every TLB entry can be either a 4K page or a 4 meg page. So, but to answer your question about how it decides the strategy, there's actually research papers on this by the guy who actually did the work, who's the PhD in this stuff. He actually really knows what he's doing. But the way the system kind of works, you only allocate the, when you map something that's very large, we look at your mapping and decide then if we think this is a good candidate for a super page, like a large page, like a 4 meg page. When you do that, then we have a kind of set of reservations, as it were. So we don't actually assign memory to your processor until you page fault each little 4K page. And if you page fault all the little 4K pages, at that time it becomes a large page. But we kind of pre-reserve the whole 4 meg or 2 meg memory chunk. But if we find that you're not using it and we start to get under memory pressure, we'll take the chunk away from you, maybe copy about the other smaller pages that are not contiguous, and then give that to somebody else. So that's really where the starvation problem is. You don't end up with the case that you have a whole bunch of memory that's reserved but not available for use. If we're ever low in memory, we'll just pull the partial reservation away from somebody and start handing the actual free unused pages back out to other things. So we don't page anything in extra from this if you actually use it. When you do swapping, it actually breaks the pages back down and only swaps out 4K chunks at a time, things like that.
Well,
does that answer your question?
If you hit page fault on a 4K page, or a 4 megabyte page, you've got to swap the whole thing in, right?
No. That's actually, so you, it reserves four megs, or actually it's almost always 2 megs now, because on the MB64, but it's going to be 2 megs, and the T, it's going to be 2 megs. You only actually fault in each individual 4K page when you get a page fault for that 4K page. So it's kind of an opportunistic reservation to say, we think we might get to use a 2 meg page here. When we get page faults, we'll pick the pages from that 2 meg physical chunk. But if we find that you don't actually use all the pages, we'll take that memory away from you, or we'll take the pages you haven't actually page faulted yet and give them away. And we don't read anything off the disk that you've actually page faulted yet.
And we only page faulted 4K at a time. You don't page fault 4 megs in off the disk.
That's what you were asking.
Yeah. Well, there's some heuristic kind of read ahead for page faulting that happens generally. But aside from that, we only bring in pages as you fault.
It's sort of overcoming the big pressures.
Kind of. But a little different. You don't have to go kill a process.
In this case, it's
kind of like over commit, but it's much looser. It's much easier to take a page and give it to somebody because it's not really a use.
Are there like any controls for developing a process or building a process specifically for one of the pages like Solaris does?
The only thing currently that it has is very recently added. Was a kind of system call where user line can find out what the available page sizes are, and malloc now uses that and tries to be a little more intelligent. That malloc will try to actually min-map a whole big page at a time, which makes it much easier for all the memory of malloc to actually end up in large pages. Mm-hmm. But that's probably the only thing available. It's much more automatic. It's not something you have to do manually like you do in some other systems.
Any other questions on soup pages before I... Okay, work continues in this area, it's probably for library officials.
He's getting better.
So, the USB stack languished for a while. It wasn't getting a lot of attention, and then we had one person come along and say they really wanted to work on it, and they did a lot. And now it works. So the big thing, of course, with USB, I mean, if you think making network drivers work is hard, which I've had to do, USB is worse because every single random piece of junk made by everyone now has some weird little USB thing in it. And getting USB to talk to not only your mouse, and your keyboard, and your thumb drive, and your other thumbs, and many other things was particularly difficult. So. At this point, in 8.0, we're still working on USB because you're working on individual drivers, but the framework and many of the drivers, all of it's running without the giant lock, it's all SMB safe. There's now a Linux compatibility layer, so if there's a Linux driver, you might be able to use that. Important is number 4, which is if you pull a thumb drive out of your laptop, it doesn't instapack. Turns out that's a relatively important feature for people. Disks come up and they never go away. And then support for newer devices, a whole bunch of different kinds of USB devices are out there now, high definition cameras, all kinds of great stuff.
Does that cover also the MMC stuff?
The which?
The MMC, SD
card? Yeah, all the, yeah.
So that'll, okay.
Yes.
Cool.
I believe all.
That really closes. Thanks.
Yeah.
Don't give me that one.
You look like somebody's taking your life. Yeah, but
they all work.
And then it also works not just on your standard Intel or Wintel laptop, but on embedded platforms as well. And I'll talk a little bit more about embedded later. But now most embedded boards come with USB for a bunch of different stuff. Okay, let's talk about embedded. So a couple of years ago. Probably a BSD can, which seems to be where all the nefarious plans get made for free BSD. There's a group of us within the project, I'm one of them, who are have a background in embedded systems. And when I did all of my first network drivers and TCP/IP stack hacking were on machines that were not desktops. They were all on very crazy embedded systems running something called VSLs. And so a couple years ago, it became really obvious that the embedded space is not only full of different applications, right? If you want to know where FreeBSD runs, it runs on far more, it ships on more embedded processors than it does, except if you count that, on desktops. So, you know, your NetApps, your Junipers, your Isilons, all these people who build these things with FreeBSD actually are not building them on a Wintel platform. They might be using Intel chip, but it's not a desktop-style system. And a couple years ago, we thought that it was the other processors were now mature enough that we could make a go of putting something as complex as FreeBSD onto embedded. And so that's been going on for a while. So in that area, we have MIPS support in this release. So there are a number of MIPS boards that are actually supported directly on FreeBSD. For those of you who like playing with small gadgets, they're also really cheap. So I'll talk about a little bit of the work that I've been doing in this area on a later slide. But my MIPS embedded board that I got was $80 for, you know, something with 600 megahertz processor and, I don't know, 128 megs of RAM and four network ports and all this crazy stuff on it. And it's a MIPS 24K 32-bit processor, and that was $80 with tax shipped to my house. Yo.
Just two quick questions. One, I mean, is it, I mean, I know there's the explosion of the embedded systems with MIPS, but it's also true of the PVC chips, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's the usual thing on any open source project, which is there were a bunch of people who wanted MIPS. Right? There are companies that use FreeBSD, and so they had a MIPS port. They donated part of that back to the project, and people could work on it. And doing a, you know, doing an entire new processor line is, it turns out, not easy. So you know, one guy in a basement could do it, but you'd have to feed him a lot of food under the door, and he wouldn't have a job. So PowerPC trails everything else at the moment. We have MIPS in this release. Xscale now has some people working on it, and there's a couple people working on PowerPC. But those are the three main ones.
My other question is, you know, is there anybody that you know could actually do reading on MIPS stuff?
Yeah.
Like John Bowen?
Well, no, actually it's Nate. Yeah. I already sent you mail about that. You want to do more on this in another talk? I even gave you a lead in the slide.
The Xscale is like the same as phones, right?
Xscale is
ARM,
right? What?
ARM Xscale?
Yeah, ARM is Xscale. Xscale is the, I don't know how to explain it. I think it's the Intel ARM. I think it runs, this is Xscale.
So
MIPS is routers in particular. It's very funny. MIPS can be big endian or little endian. And the board that I got, the previous generation was little endian, and they made it as a network board. I'm like, the network byte order is big endian. You were really dumb. That's why there's a second version of the board. So a lot of router vendors like Juniper use MIPS, because that way you've got a native byte order, which Intel doesn't have. Other questions?
Spark.
There are still people looking at Spark 64, but that's not embedded. And not much going on there.
Actually, Ultra, you can run it on...
On an Ultra.
Well, on the Spark 3s. Yeah. In 8.0.
And people are looking at T2.
Some
pretty, but that's pretty... Yeah.
Not a lot.
That's not happening at all. Hey, let's talk about the NARC stack, because it's my favorite part of that. So, I'm going to talk, again, this is sort of an outline of what I'll talk about. Virtualized network stack, which we can talk a lot about. Wireless mesh networking, which there's actually a really good presentation from EuroBSD about that. Virtual access points, multiple routing tables, new forwarding information base, et cetera, et cetera. Zero copy BPF, and NFS. For some reason, people think that adding a file system over the network is a great idea. I think they're wrong.
It's a great idea until you use NFS.
Yeah. So let's talk about network stack virtualization. This was a feature that was actually built by a guy, Marco Zek, for FreeBSD 4. And he did this because he wanted to have multiple virtual network stacks for his students. He wanted people to be able to experiment. Yeah, it was for students. So the idea was to be able to have multiple stacks talking to each other all on the same machine. And this was, of course, many years ago, and a lot of people had things like VMware. Marco did this network stack virtualization. And if you think that doing an SMP kernel is hard, try doing that to the network stack. So I can tell you how many global variables there were in the network stack, and there's a lot of them. So the network stack is now what we call fully virtualized in FreeBSD 8.0, but what does that mean? You know, I can tell you it's a great feature. You can all go home and look it up. So, other than using it as a teaching device where you can actually run multiple network stacks and do very interesting things with IPFW, there are large commercial people who would like to have more than one network stack running in a box. So, you know, imagine you've got a router, or certainly a router. Imagine you've got a router, you put it in a data center, and you want to, in your data center, virtualize all of that, right? So you can do that with VMware, you can virtualize your servers, but you want to virtualize the network, and you want to give multiple people access and control over their network. So you're a large ISP, or you're a provider, and you have, the example I always use when we looked at this, was you have Pepsi and Coca-Cola, and you both want to be in the same data center,
right?
But you don't want to give them, you know, the same network. Well, if at some layer, and in particular this is done at the software layer, you actually have completely separate interfaces, completely separate routing table, completely separate ARP table, completely separate I/O controls, everything is virtualized, but you only have to buy one box, this makes people really happy. And so, you know, virtualized network stacks has worked on for quite a while because, you know, in a multi-threaded kernel like 3BSD, you can't virtualize something like this if you've got a single global pointer. So before all this work was done, there was a single global pointer to all TCP connections, all interfaces, the routing table. Every single thing you could think of that you ever manipulated from user space in the kernel was pointed to generally somewhere by a single global pointer that was, you know, TCP info. Here's the beginning of all the TCP sockets. So the same kind of thing you had to do when you went from a single processor kernel where you could have, you know, you could set the SPL, you could set the processor level, you could say, well, at the moment, no one else is allowed to touch this. And you went from that to having mutexes and locks and data structures that are locked, and you have a true multi-threaded kernel. Well, those locks work fine until you want a virtualized piece of software. So if you want a virtualized network stack, you then have to have an array of pointers to the TCP sockets. You have to have an array of pointers to X, an array of pointers to Y. Everything needs an array of pointers. And, you know, it makes the system harder to debug, it makes it very complex. So this took a while, and this is in 8.0. And so now when you start your system, you have a single network stack, and then you can say, I would like more than one, I'd like N of them. It's kind of like starting a jet. So now, and then each stack, of course, has its own routing table, its interface list, its sockets, and to the applications use it to I have configured all this stuff, it looks like if you're the network jail user, if you're Pepsi or Coke, you look like you only have Pepsi or Coke's network. If you run the box, you can see everyone, right? And so that's what virtualized network stacks give you. And it's actually a really cool, very tough feature to implement. It's incredibly useful in a lot of ways, some of which are quite surprising.
How much of that is macros? What's the split between TCP stack and the drivers?
So the drivers actually do not need to understand this because you've got the IFNet list, right? So a single driver can talk to multiple IFNets. So the drivers did not have to be virtualized in this way. It's everything above the driver and up, which, you know, there are many drivers, so collectively they have more lines of code. But if you break the network stack, you break all the drivers, and everyone's network can get off.
Yeah. And then NetScreen, Juniper's NetScreen, has virtual routers. So I guess this is different.
This is a way to provide that. I don't know how Juniper did the NetScreen product, or was the NetScreen a product before Juniper bought them?
Yeah.
I don't know how the NetScreen people did it. Maybe they use Marco's patch, or maybe they did it on their own. But everyone's done network. Anyone who wants this kind of feature has done something like this. I actually worked on a similar feature when I did embedded systems using a BSD stack. Yes?
So is this something that's always enabled? I mean, always enabled?
It is not always enabled.
It's a custom kernel.
It's a custom kernel. You have to build your own kernel for that.
So there's no performance impact if I don't compile
it? No. Yes.
So what controls what virtual network process has
the
context? Is it all
jail control?
Or no.
Yes. And the interface is you create a jail, and when you create a jail, you can create a jail that has a VNet,
yeah,
effectively. So the actual user line interface is that when you create a jail, some jails get their own separate network stack instead of having inherited the parent's network stack.
So it's not system-wide settings?
No, it's not
a system. Well, so that's what I said. It's by jail that you, that the process
right. Is... Well, if you can create a jail that's just a VNet that doesn't have the security features of a jail that's a pure VNet that is just that. Or you can create a pure jail. Or you can create a jail that has all the security stuff and a virtual network stack. So you can mix and match them. So that's like, a higher up a jail.
But basically, you don't, in ifconfig, you don't say, oh, by the way, in virtual network 4, ifconfig this. You wind up doing it because you've done that. But you don't have to have the jail. I mean, other than that, you use the jail interface. You don't actually have the jail stuff on.
But the jail admin, jail group has the ability to fully use ifconfig.
Well, it depends. You can pick
if you enable that.
Well, yes, but they can't ifconfig someone else's.
They can do on ifconfig locally.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, where does this open up? I obviously every time you use, you know, get too permissive with your syscontrol knobs with jails, you open up potential security problems. I mean, you sit there and someone starts doing the same IP address as the host.
But what can happen is you can take a network interface and stick it in a completely different network stack. It's invisible actually to the host, like the overall host. You can basically dedicate a NIC to a single virtual net.
You get this
you
one.
You can move them around between the virtual nets and assign things that way. And then you can just config all that interface inside your virtual network stack and you will really own it.
And the great thing is I can never talk to you.
Well, I was going to say, this is fun. I mean, there's also, I mean, the nice thing is, also, I mean, to me, there's, you know, a bunch of jail boxes that are going in. Lots of people have jails on in this room, actually.
You're all about to lose your network.
But I'm not SPAMD yet. I don't know, I think people have gotten SPAMD running in jails. I don't know about that yet. But with PF, or IPFW, you're just giving people full control of firewalling. And the jails is nice.
Yes, because like they're all firewalling themselves. Yeah. Right? They don't screw you over.
Yep. Or that's not to be centrally managed from the host. That's the most important.
Yeah. That's a very great one. Can you make tunnels that cross the RFs that are really tall? So like the outer processing
one. Can you make a tunnel between two virtual stacks?
So it could be like a different tunnel, or it could be the VLAN is sort of like a tunnel.
You can either do it kind of by going all the way out one network back in.
You can do it, but you have to.
Or there's actually a special netcraft node they have that will basically kind of
connect to
do a pipe that goes between two and create interfaces in each VNet, and you can pass that between VNets that way.
Wow. So it's like a line of cable.
I'm not sure, but I know that VLANs create their own IFNet, so it might be possible to create all the separate VLANs out of the host and then move them inside the VNet, so they would each be a physical kind of interface inside the different network stacks that way.
Is the MAC address the same across all of them?
Yeah, because that's just the hardware. The hardware is not virtualized. It's purely when the packet comes out of the driver, where does it go then?
Someone mentioned something about IP addresses stepping on other IP addresses. Is there any way to ensure that someone doesn't do that, or that one virtual network stack, one fixed address, finds an IP address which is the same as something else? Is there any way to? I don't know that explicitly in VNet that prevents that.
That's a problem you don't have in the network anyway.
That's why I was thinking of the tagging, because then you couldn't do that. Is that going to be an invalid IP address? It could be done.
I don't believe there's support in there for that. It's probably something that would have to go in somewhere.
Because like when people use the RF, this is what they want. Because the different customers are using the same RFC 9. If you're going to do hosting jails, you should have two interfaces, one with the management that has nothing to do with IP addresses that are available to them.
But there's a question of, if he has a jail, I have a jail, and then we both set 192.168.1.1, and that happens to coincide with the same physical interface, then how does, you know, the OS give us our backup?
I think a physical interface may only be in one VNet at a time. But in a non-VNetted jail, you can do the normal thing. You put aliases and you put one L0 inside the jail and on the alias outside the jail. I think with a VNet, I think the physical interface can only belong to one VNet. And there's one VNet in the whole system, and it has children. The physical port is only in one of them. And that might be how that works. So you can basically dedicate a physical port on either your machine if you have like two NICs. You have one for one network stack and one for the other.
And if you're doing this in a really big box, you're going to have a bunch of quad ports, and you know, it's just like one for each. Other questions? So, wireless underwent a major overhaul, as those of us who were trying to write a new book found out. I got halfway through the chapter, and then I read the code in 8, and I was like, oh, damn it. So, one of the important things is, and actually it is a massive improvement over the previous system, because you can actually understand the separation between different bits of the wireless. If you've ever looked at an Ethernet driver and you thought that was complex, you should look at a Wi-Fi driver and then take a drive, because Wi-Fi is way more complex than Ethernet. So one of the things that goes in here is there's actually a software concept in the kernel now in the virtual access plane. So if you've got a more modern Wi-Fi device, it's got multiple radios, or it's got the ability to have multiple channels active at the same time, then that's actually nicely subclassed in this thing called the virtual access plane. And that's actually the central data structure in the Wi-Fi stack for dealing with wireless. It's very much the case in wireless devices that almost all of the, I guess, the interesting things that are done in hardware, all the crypto, all this other stuff, really is done in hardware. I mean, those drivers are really, for the most part, not open source. Atheros and Broadcom and all these people, you know, they provide a very static control plane that you interact with. But a lot of the work that gets done in Wi-Fi to do all of the interesting things, to do, you know, to do the searching, to find the access points, all this stuff, that's all done in the NIT 802.11 layer, and then the hardware is actually abstracted through the hardware abstraction layer. That's very different. So some of the things that went into wireless for improvement, you get these virtual access points. You can have, you know, you can have your machine be a station and be a router at the same time if you've got enough radios in it. It's a complete overhaul of all of that. And one of the things that came, one of the things that comes with that, one of the guys on the project, Uri Paulo, who's from Portugal, has been doing a huge amount of work on mesh networking. So there's a pretty hot topic at the moment. This is, you don't have a specific access point, you've just got a bunch of nodes, and there are protocols for dealing with that, and that's one of the things that Uri's put into the system for FreeBSD8. And one of the reasons we could do that is because there was a complete overhaul of how wireless works.
That plus the virtualized DCBHP stack and everything in the mix is a beautiful combination.
I hope so.
That's fun, that right there, that's a lot of fun.
Does the mesh stuff work with all chips, or has it not?
I don't know which specific drivers. I'm sure it works with Atheros, because the Atheros stuff is what our stuff always works with first, because Sam Loeffler, who did a lot of the wireless stuff, had a really good relationship with them for a long time. And they're actually relatively good to us.
So you're still using Loeffler's
now? Yeah, Loeffler's the one who did that overall. He's one of these virtual access points.
I think any driver with those virtual access points can do the mesh. Because the mesh just deals with virtual access.
Yeah, the mesh is above the hardware. It's just got to add the right, because the protocol is actually in software. What is it? Something 3.03. So, for those of you who've ever looked at a radix tree lookup, we still have that. You don't want to look at it. I only know two people who understand how it works. One of them coded it. But it's interesting. I mean, FreeBSD and actually all of the BSDs have had a pretty similar routing table system for a long time. And that routing table stored everything. It stored your ARP table, it stored all of your routes. There was a lot of information in the routing table. And this made sense in 1980-something when it was originally coded. But people who build routers and switches do not build routers and switches this way. Right? I mean, a router and switch, router or switch, there's a huge amount of data that's kept in what's called the forwarding information base. Right? That's, you know, not a routing lookup, that's just, you know, here's a hardware address or here's an IP address, give me the hardware address, let's go. And so that separation of concerns has been present in routers and switches. It's got to be at least a decade. And so recently, a couple of people working on the project finally did this also for FreeBSD. There's a complete, pretty much, tear down, rebuild of the ARP layer and the routing layer. It's using the same algorithms to do the lookups, but the way in which you interact with it and things that it can do are separate. So now we have what router people usually call a ribbon of fit. There's the routing information base. That's, you know, given this and a net mask, walk the Patricia tree and do all this stuff, and oh, it's this interface. But then there's a lower level stuff, which is a forwarding information base, which is on which interface does this address exist? That's the FIB. That's things like ARP. And for the people who use IPv6, that's, you know, all the neighbor discovery and NV6. That's the same kind of table. So ARP's now its own table. It's not mixed with the routes. And the hope is that this is a platform for development for more advanced networking devices. One of the features you get out of, that we got out of doing this, one of the features that was implemented with this stuff going in there, is equal cost multi-path routing, which I didn't make a page on, so I'll do that. So the idea between for equal cost multi-path routing is that, you know, you've got two interfaces and it might be that they don't have a different cost. Usually in a routing protocol, it's like, well, to get from me to the back of the room, if I go this way, it costs 4 hops. If I go this way, it costs 3 hops. But you've got systems where that's not always the case, and you want to be able to do things like load balancing and all this other stuff, and you need to have equal cost multi-path routing. And actually, it was the person who started working on this first was working on a project where they needed that. And they realized to get that, they had to basically either do a lot of extra work or just split it up. So that's the difference. Yo, 2 questions.
So I have a question about GRE tunnels.
About what?
GRE tunnels. Maybe related, but I'm not sure. So I figured I'd just ask. But in the past, if the GRE tunnel had some of the overhead, you could adjust the MTU size correspondingly.
Right.
Trim some along. But in the case of Linux, that it auto discovered that and it worked correctly. Previously, had a syscall to do that, but it never seemed to work for various reasons. And I wasn't sure if that was me or if that was something that was.
I actually don't know.
Okay.
Because I don't actually use that.
Did Bluecoat's contribution go into this?
I have nothing to say. Yeah. Well done. Yeah, they were the ones who needed that. Okay. So, other questions? Okay. All right, let's talk about this ridiculous stuff about network file systems. It's a really bad idea. I don't know how Sun made money doing this. we now have support for NFSv4. It changes how namespaces are exported. One of the things that it makes easier, which may or may not matter to people in the room, is dealing with NFS from a non-Unix client, which means Windows. So one of the reasons for changes to the way the namespace is exported was to support Windows hosts better, because they have a different idea of how the namespace should look. One of the nice things, for those of you who've ever had to deal with performance problems in NFS, is that you can now group RPC calls. So NFSv4, instead of, you know, do this, get an answer, do this, get an answer, do this, get an answer, which is not a very efficient way to do work, you can now bunch up a bunch of RPCs and they all go at once. For NFSv4, TCP is now required, no more UDP for NFSv4. A bunch of the security stuff is also required for v4. As I said at the end, better support for Windows clients. It's an important feature. People are going to use it. May God have mercy on their souls. I just don't like the idea of a network file system. Yeah.
Good question. So in 8, RC 1 and 2, there was now a majority of new NFS?
Yes.
Right? Is that representative of v4 stuff or rewriting the NFS?
You don't get the V4 stuff without it.
It's a rewrite.
And, but, and then you do get the, yes, you're getting the new code if you do that.
Is there any advantage for V3? Or
oh, yeah. Yeah, there's, well, there's all locking stuff.
Oh, the locking stuff is in both. Yeah. The code is locked later. Have you ever looked at the NFS source code?
You did.
Oh, God. So, this is the only code I've ever seen that
defines... Oh, I want you to do this on lock. Yeah, he's going to
come. The only code I've ever seen that defines the macro that contains the go-to to a label that's always defined in the macro, that's done in the new client. Thank God.
There you go. I had to hear about that for a moment.
Does that mean the curve is in the kernel now?
Mm, no, it's just
no, it's just that
it's there are links between them.
Yeah.
Okay, so some features about storage. I thought this is a pretty funny one. When we did the previous 8 slides at EuroBSD.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had to do like a very short version of this at EuroBSD. You know, it was like a 5-minute whip session, you know, with somebody up an 8, and for some reason I got tagged as doing it, I don't know why. And you know, I get this like side message from Pavel saying, oh, by the way, ZFS is production quality. I'm like, really? I thought you just said it wasn't going to be production quality. He's like, no, it is. I'm like, all right, fine. ZFS is now production quality. No longer experimental. Actually, ZFS has been production quality for a while. It's a pretty solid piece of software. My desktop, all of my data on my desktop is in ZFS. And as someone who routinely crashes their desktop because I'm doing something strange to it, it's great because it doesn't fuzz check the 400 gigs of disk drive that are standard on my desktop. So, I mean, if for nothing else, it's useful for that. So ZFS is now production quality.
Is it integrated to sysinstall or install now?
Not yet. That's next. Probably in 8.1. John rolls his eyes at me. Rolling rise of me. Anyway, new driver for ACI, GBI num version 2, Xeon parts now to the fall. BSD labels extended to 26 partitions. If you feel that you need a partition for every lowercase letter of the alphabet, that's how we came up with 26. I was like, that number looks really familiar. Oh, the American, the English ASCII alphabet. So yeah, you can have a lot of partitions move. That's most of what it is on storage. You can tell that I'm not a storage guy because you only get one slide. I didn't say it worked. some changes in ZFS. Full formats updated to version 13 from 6. That's not something you're really going to notice. Everything migrates normally. You just bring up your old stuff and it works. Lots of bug fixes, lots of performance tweaks, no one to mark experimental. And the installer support hopefully coming soon. I believe the next version of PCBSD. Yes,
yeah,
the new version of PCBSD for those of you who use that, which is actually pretty cool. If you don't say recompile your kernel on a weekly basis and experiment with device drivers, then PCBSD is actually really good. They're much more. They've now gotten to the point where they're much closer to FreeBSD head. They're actually tracking us really, really well. And their new installer does do, you know, ZFS out of the box.
Yeah. And the new installer for PCBSD, they said in Europe, will actually let you install stock FreeBSD. So you can use a much better installer to install stock FreeBSD on the ZFS if you want.
No, this install is awesome.
It's beautiful.
I use sysinstall, I've been
hurt.
So change to GM parts now the default slicer, you'll see some warnings from that. If you're mounting older file systems, you can ignore those. You can have more than 8 partitions, and like I said, 26 partitions, less than the number of lowercase alphabetic ASCII letters. I'd like to have my ZFS be part C.
Yes.
Does GM part have anything to do with GPT partitions?
Yes.
Oh yeah, and you use GPT if at all possible instead of BSD labels parse through. And you can, it's bootable with ZFS or UFS. It's not bootable for VFI, if you want to VFI on 32 yet, but you can boot from the BIOS of GPT.
Can you explain the relationship better between GM part and GPT?
Okay.
Yes, you can.
First of all, are you familiar with GM at all? You may completely not understand GM. It's just a framework for managing storage devices, usually used for things like different partition table strategies. GM part is, so back up a little bit. GM has a bunch of classes for different things, whether it's how to parse an FDIS table, a how to parse a BSD label table, or a GPT table, or even there's some classes to do things like simple variant or brain 5 or things like that, striking.
And crypto.
Yeah, there's any, you can do all sorts of different things with this, the GEOM. It's just kind of a generic framework for that sort of thing. There were, when GEOM was first written in 5.0, I think it was one of the there were several.
You were on RE.
Hey, gosh. There were several classes added to do things like the BSD table. Someone eventually wrote a GPT table parser or a DBR table. What GEOM part is somebody sat down and wrote a new kind of class which has to better, more abstractly handle all sorts of different types of tables and then have a specific plugin for GPT or NVR or FDIS or things like that. So that's what it's added about. It's just a new set of classes to manage common disk partition tables. And you really should use GPT anyway. It's much better than Scrum.
So there are GPT parsers in GEOM?
Well, the old ones are basically gone. At this point, you can kind of manually turn them on, but at this point they're deprecated. You should really just stick with a new one and throw them out of fall. So
can I create GPT partitions and sysinstall it?
Not in sysinstall. The way I actually prefer to fix that is to make it possible that you can escape to a shell and make your disk however you want, and then tell sysinstall to install here.
Because everybody escapes to a shell to make their disk.
Well, there's a complex thing. Having worked on the sysinstall code, it's a royal pain in the butt to make it do anything. So. Eventually it'll get there. But like I said, the installer for PCBSD that can install stock BSD, apparently it does support GPT and VCFS. So, that's a problem.
Okay, well that's the end of the 8.0 presentation. Now we can do the pie in the sky stuff of everything we're going to do for 9.0, which I'm sure we'll all get done. And John was also involved in this, so he's probably going to jump up at some point. Since this comes from, this basically comes almost directly from the developer summit at EuroBSD where we talked about, well, what are we going to do for Encore? some of this stuff is actually getting done. Almost all of this is actually getting done right now. So how many of you have heard about Grand Central Dispatch, which is what runs in Snow Leopard? Okay, so that's pretty much done. For FreeBSD. It's not going to go into 8, but that's actually there, and the person who's working on it is Robert Watson, and I think he was fixing a few bugs today, but the code's there, and it's actually announced. I expect that will definitely be a 9.0. Other things we'll see, massively multi-core embedded systems, there's support for a board called the RMI, I think it's the RMI board, going into the tree now, and I don't remember if it's got 16 cores? 64 cores. Yeah, there's a 64 core MIPS board that we're going to support in 9.0, and so if you're a...
4 threads per core, something ridiculous. 120 threads.
Excellent. You'll be able to do a whole lot of nothing really fast. But this is obviously for people who are building up big routers and switches, massive machines. It's actually a really cool system. That's not $80, by the way. It's much more expensive part. But we're going to see a lot more of that. You know, it's interesting because Sun was really pushing their Niagara stuff for a while, and we thought that would kind of be the first thing that went by the 4 or 8 core barrier. And then this database company seems to have bought a hardware company, and that's probably not going to happen. But you'll see massively built the core embedded systems. You'll see at least one. You'll probably see more than that. That's I've been seeing check-ins going in past that, so that's actually the best work that's being done. Zen DOM 0, which is more of this virtualization stuff, you'll get, instead of being within DOM, you will actually be able to host Zen, so you'll be able to have your FreeBSD running your FreeBSDs on top of it. So all be FreeBSD, instead of the Zen part. Possibly support for InfiniBand. There's actually people who've done InfiniBand, which is, InfiniBand, for those who don't know, is a high-end, I wouldn't say boutique, but it's a high-end networking backplane used by people like, for instance, Isilon to connect massive numbers of nodes together to build up file systems. So there's support for that. There's been support for that for Linux for a while, and there has been proprietary support for it for certain bits of FreeBSD and certain products, but it's not made it back into the tree. We expect that to make it back into the tree for 9. You raise your hand or you just wait.
Okay.
Is
Is InfiniBand, InfiniBand utilizing GEOM stuff, or is it?
No, InfiniBand is a networking technology. So you have.
Oh, it's a different layer.
Yeah, so you build a file system on top of nodes connected by InfiniBand.
Right.
So InfiniBand is a networking technology that has never become mainstream because it's always been faster than Ethernet, but it's never been cheaper, and you have to be both. So.
You have to price it compared to like 10 gig or something.
Even so, because at the moment you can get 40 gig InfiniBand. You can get 40 gigabit like off the shelf switches and cards. They're always kind of one step ahead. So it's a nice technology, but only people who are doing high performance computing, like, you know, they have large black budgets from a group with three letters down near DC, they would have InfiniBand.
They need a power system.
Yeah.
I met somebody on the 31st
in
an HPC cluster. He's only used this Ethernet for the main one, but he has a 200 node research cluster as InfiniBand.
Yeah.
And that for the stuff that he's buying, it's actually 48 times cheaper than 10 gig. Yeah.
Really?
But it depends on that. And there's other people that say, no, fuck you, mine still.
I personally do not have enough money to buy an InfiniBand cluster, so.
What they do is they put switches inside the blades.
Yeah.
It's like
it's a mesh.
Package.
Yeah. You have lower latency with InfiniBand, too.
Yes.
Something we care about.
For some computers. ZFS is a default. I mean, UFS was a wonderful file system. I'd like a moment of silence for UFS. But if you're running anything that's larger than 100 gigs, you really want to have something that never f-sucks, because that's just not a good thing. Yes?
Any plans for Hammer, or is that just staying off
the board? When Hammer is a production quality file system, we will certainly be interested in looking at the code. See, the great thing about the futures list is I could put anything on here. Like, I could say that we were going to give you all cake. And so this list is really... but some of the stuff is actually been worked on. In particular, we're still in the realm of somewhat reality. So another presentation that was at EuroBSD was a student, Wojcik, I can't pronounce his last name, I can probably not pronounce his first name, who had done support for these really cool boards called NetFPGAs. So if you want to start doing really cool offloading of text processing or intrusion detection systems, things like that. You run FreeBSD on these FPGAs that are being built is very cool. And we're hoping to get him some boards to work with and actually get the code into FreeBSD. Turns out enough people use IPv6 now that they'd like to turn off IPv4. So the ability to build an IPv6 only kernel. A lot of the network performance stuff that we're seeing now, as you get to 10 gig and as we go to 40 gig Ethernet, and if we do InfiniBand, there's a whole bunch of stuff we have to do in software that we didn't have to do before that we really want to be able to do. We want to do more offloading than we've done before. So you know, now you've got TCP is offloaded on 1 gig and 10 gig, checksum is offloaded on 1 gig and 10 gig, but now you've got to think about other things like, well, if I've got 10 gig and I really want to get all those packets out, giving the packet to the device driver onesie twosie, like here's a packet, take it, here's a packet, that doesn't work. You want to say, oh, I've got 50 packets, transmit these. I've got 50 more packets, transmit these. And so that's support that's got to go in there.
How do you get by the window size? It's small on TCP.
Well, if your window size isn't big, you're not going to be handed down at the interface layer. Like TCP is way up here. And when TCP is handing stuff down to you, it doesn't have to hand it down to you once it chooses. You can say, here's the beginning and the end of this list. Take that, hack it up, send it out the interface, and then depending on what your hardware supports, and there's actually hardware where you can say, here's a pointer, and you know, do everything. We'll do almost everything. So being able to do packet batching, tying packet dispatch to per CPU. So it turns out to be wildly inefficient to have a packet come in on CPU 7 and, you know, or CPU 0 and then go to an application on CPU 6. It'd be great if that was all in a line. So that's something for 9. Revising MBUS and tags. This is kind of like the classic, the wheel of reincarnation is what Sam calls it. So, you know, for those of us who are old enough, like first you had central computers, and then you had personal computers, and then you had X terminals, and then you had desktops, and you would go back and forth. MBUFs and tags do this in the kernel, which is, well, we need a bunch of metadata for MBUFs, but we don't want to make the MBUF any bigger, so we'll make all these tags. Oh, wait, processing tags on the list is really slow, so we'll take them all and we'll shove them into the MBUF. But now we've got new things we want to put in the MBUF, so we'll make a whole bunch more tags. So I'm not sure where in the wheel this particular list is, but this is something that will be changed for 9. There's a bunch of stuff, in particular, when you get towards 10 gig networking, where you see a whole bunch of cache effects. It turns out if you are perfectly cache aligned, that kind of sucks. Because as the processor reads through to get the packet out, you actually miss. And you want to be slightly misaligned. There's a whole bunch of stuff in MBUFs that you'd like to do to change it. I promise we will never have ski buffs with 87 entries in them. No, we never have. But we are going to look at how MBUFs are laid out and how they're set up for 9.0. Multi-key transit support, this is something related, similar to the packet batching stuff, where instead of batching up packets, you've got a single PHY or a single connection, but you've got multiple queues. So the way you get 10 gigabits to actually go through a machine is you, in particular for TCP, the hardware will spray the packets across a set of queues that the multiple cores in the machine can pick the data up from. Because if you're going through a single queue, you may not be able to do line rate. So the way you do line rate is you're like, oh, and this mostly works only for TCP because TCP is good on this. You can hash it well. And you're like, okay, well, I've got 8 cores, and I've got 8 queues in my 10 gig net, and I'm just going to spray that data across the queue and across those 8 queues, and then those 8 cores can actually get the data, and that's how you do line rate on 10 gig.
Does the hardware sort it by connection?
Yes. Yeah. If it doesn't sort it by connection, bad things happen. Turns out if you reorder TCP, you don't have to worry about reaching line rate ever.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of different hashes that can be used in the hardware for that. And you can actually, on some of the fairly advanced hardware, you can decide. You can say, you could say, I want all VLAN tags at this and wind up in Q0. You could think of that as some sort of thing for the kernel. You can use some fancy stuff. Being able to do connection groups, 802.11, 802.1p may already be implemented. I didn't know when I wrote the slides. Not more for 9.0. So one very productive developer is really concerned with power, and that's Paul Henning. And so we're expecting to see a whole bunch of stuff for power management at 9. Things like, so a 10 gig NIC, you know how much power a 10 gig NIC sucks up just by being there? It's like several watts. Sitting there with a laser on, it's like, it's a 1 watt laser, and you've got to run all the shit around it too. So people who build data centers want to be able to do things like say, well, if I'm not using this NIC, even if the machine's up, stop stealing my watts, right? So being able to power down NICs, being able to correctly handle C2, C1E states, where you don't have a timer anymore, so you need a backup timer like the high performance, whatever it is, HPAD, the good timer. Be able to tell it, oh, by the way, when I wake up, could you fix all of my timers? Because they've all been off for however long. So power management's going to probably show up at 9. Lots more embedded support, AVR32, MIPS64. I definitely believe MIPS64 will be in there. And there's at least 2 people working on AVR32. Okay, enough already. Now this is getting into more of the, pie in the sky stuff. Parallel device attached, being able to, instead of saying, oh, this device, this device, this device, we'd like, you'd like a box, say if you had a phone that ran FreeBSD, like this one, you'd like it not to take 3 minutes to reboot, right? That would be great. USB video device support, express card, NUMA support. There's already some limited NUMA support in the tree. Did you check that in?
It's not in the head, no.
Okay, but there will be soon. And so NUMA is non-uniform memory architecture, so if you've got a new Nehalem box with 2 processors, and you only plug in 1 processor, but you fill up all the memory slots, you'll find out you only get half your memory, because this memory is for processor 1, and this memory is for processor 2, and that gives you a non-uniform memory architecture. That means that, when I ask for memory, I get it from here, and he asks for memory, he gets it from there, but it's important for the OS to kind of know where memory comes from, because if it doesn't, you're going to get some really nasty corner cases of inefficiencies where one processor is asking for memory that's much slower. So, NUMA support for mount synchro thread, mandatory access control for ZFS. This is another thing that's really important for embedded, which is much better flash file system support and NANDI support. That's what you need if you're going to do embedded systems. And then I don't know if I want to take a bet with anyone to see if this one's even 9, but a tickless kernel or deadline scheduling. This is a very different way of doing scheduling and dealing with the way the kernel schedules time. And I think it would be interesting. What was that? So a tickless kernel is basically, a tickless kernel means you don't have the timer waking up every so often to move time forward. Right? So you've got this, the kernel can just move forward on its own. And then deadline scheduling is the ability to say, well, you know, at this deadline you fail. Right? And that gets you more towards a sort of more towards a real-time system. Well, I don't have a lot of faith in that. Won't he ever shut up? Probably not. So some other stuff. Oh wait, hey, we're back in Netherland. You can all go to sleep now. So anybody heard of the GPLv3? It turns out we use a compiler that's under GPLv3 now, and this really pissed off a certain large laptop and desktop vendor who has only 2% of the market, but they had the pretty machines. And so they went out and they found these guys who've been doing this, so it was a little virtual machine, I think, is what all of the VM stands for. So some people have been building compilers that didn't suck, unlike GCC, and which you could debug and understand. And Apple hired them and a bunch of their friends, and they started building this thing, and it's still open source. So one of our goals has been to get off of GCC and get onto something like LLVM and their compiler, which is called Clang. But we can't do that until you can completely compile the kernel and do all the other stuff that we need to do with it. But that's actually a very active area of work for FreeBSD right now, is to move compilers. And you don't just get a BSD, moving to LLVM and Clang from GCC, you don't just get a compiler that's got an awesome license, which is a BSD license. What you get is actually something that you can change the back end on, that you can really configure to your environment. One of the reasons Apple, I mentioned their name, went and got these guys in, wasn't just because they were really nice people who wanted to have a really good open source compiler. What a modular compiler like LLVM gives you is the ability to change what kind of code you generate on the back end. And Apple used that to generate graphics code, to generate graphics instructions and all this other stuff. The LLVM guys gave a presentation on this about a year ago at BSDCamp. Once you've got this better compiler, you can actually do a lot of really interesting things in terms of optimizing specific types of code. Like, imagine optimizing network code, or optimizing string code, or optimizing all kinds of stuff. So it's not just better because of the license, it's better because it's a much more modern technology. GCC was actually written specifically to stymie people trying to extend it.
Yep.
But I'm not going to get into that range because I don't have enough time. Userland dtrace, for those of you who use dtrace in the kernel, it's extremely useful, but there's a whole bunch of people who'd be like to use it for their user applications. Having looked at this problem, first of all, if you print out the code for dtrace, it's about that thick. It takes about a week to go through it. Dtrace does a huge amount of stuff, and userland dtrace is going to be, it's an order of magnitude more work than doing it in the kernel. Basically getting PID tracing, all this, being able to trace a process. This is definitely something we're trying to do for 9. Parallel package adds, which, we're finally going to move away from FTP. I'm sorry, but FTP is dead. It turns out a lot of firewalls don't open FTP, and so if you're trying to do package installs, it's a total pain in the butt, and this may seem to be very, very minor, but it turns out for a large amount of the world, it's really important, so we're going to update that. So I mentioned a whole bunch of stuff, right? I bet nobody remembers half of the things I mentioned that we want to work on. so how are we going to do all of this? I mean, there's only a couple hundred source committers and some number of people who are testing the stuff and then all the ports committers. How are we going to deal with that? So this is my plea for volunteers at the end of the meeting, which is we always need new volunteers, right? So you know, join and read the mailing list, send in packets to the list. And if you want to work on something, whenever I give a talk, whether I give a talk about network drivers or I give a talk about FreeBSD in general, you know, one or two people usually come up and talk to me and say, well, you know, I always wanted to work on this. If there's some part of an OS you always wanted to work on, come talk to me after this or send me an email on gn@freebsd.com. Because pretty much everyone who's talked to me after one of my talks has become, in the last year, a source committer. Right? Because it, people usually have good ideas and interesting things to work on, and all they need is a couple of pointers to, you know, go in the right direction, and then you can be contributing code, and you can get up here and give this talk in 10 years, and I'm too old to do it. Really? I won't be too old by then. I'll be 52. All right, so that's the end of the talk. That's the last slide. Any questions? Can someone find me the waitress so I can order dinner?
Do you have any numbers on performance-wise on LLVM versus GCC?
I don't have anything on LLVM versus GCC. We can't yet build the entire kernel with it, so we can't.
Can we?
I didn't think we could.
I think it's only C++ that doesn't work at this point. And even for that works.
There's no C++ in the kernel yet.
No, but like they've got most of the rules built. I think it's only stuff like trough that doesn't build with client kernel.
Oh, well, I'm not going to use a system that doesn't have trough. What the hell wrong with you? I know you couldn't build the whole kernel. I thought there was a special bit you could. I don't know.
I can do that.
Other questions? Yes?
FreeBSD versus NetBSD, OpenBSD, all the wonderful things that you were talking about, virtualization for the networking stack. Are the other BSDs doing any of this stuff?
OpenBSD is claimed they're never going to do the SMP, right?
They actually put SMP in there.
No, there's no SMP.
No, they have SMP, but it's...
That's better for
It's like previously for SMP.
Okay.
Yeah.
You still got the giant log. Well, that's not to me. That's not SMP, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't think the virtual stuff, virtual network stacks, I don't think will show up in OpenBSD. NetBSD, I don't know. I mean, the stuff I've seen from NetBSD. What?
I can speak to NetBSD.
Yeah, sure.
Say there's people from every project.
Yeah.
NetBSD has a research project. Actually, it's available in NetBSD 5. Still being developed in current, where many components of the kernel with the compile time switch can be virtualized as a standalone program, so I use that. And there's one recently as an experiment he did where there's an NFS server, and it comes to, like when you start with NFSD, it's got all the kernel code in it for NFS, if it runs RPC, if everything's needed, all inside each one of
it. Is this on the stuff, on the config?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Keep going. The system is called RUM.
Yeah.
The idea is that you virtualize the components of the kernel so that the same code that's in the kernel can be recompiled by flipping a switch that you realize.
Yeah. Yeah, Omni seems to pull everything out of the kernel at some point.
Good.
So other features, I'm gonna call him an FBSD person since he spoke up. So any of the other stuff that you can think of that's going to wind up in there? I mean, you guys are working on SMP. Are you working on FIND?
Yes. Oh yeah.
SMP right now, right? Is that in 5 or is that going to be in IPSD 6?
As far as virtualizing.
No. The full SMP stuff, because you guys went and did a different version of SMP then.
I could tell you one.
Okay.
Other things that are being virtualized, though, the USB stack, actually, you can run a wireless USB driver all the way down that first stack.
So can anyone speak to Open while we're here? OpenBSD? OPA?
Well, since we've got multiple, it has support for multiple routing cables.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been fully revamped.
Yeah, so the presentation.
I mean, SMP support is still
not as well. Are you guys working on that then, or not?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there was discussion at one point about from the OpenBSD group that was like, we're just not going to do that.
No, it's
not. Okay.
It's just
there's
a slow
Well, I got to tell you, how long was it supposed to take originally? 6 months?
No, nobody's so fast.
What was the 2 years? What was the original one?
Oh, four, no.
Come on, there's that mail from John Lyman.
Well, I mean, no, that's the thing, you throw it all out and start over. Maybe it'll take them less time.
Can you?
Good, sorry.
Do you know if there's an open door with EC2 for running FreeBSD?
Well, there's a what?
Oh, for Amazon EC2.
For Amazon, I don't know.
So the current thing is that Zen is being developed for 3.0.1, and EC2 is 3.0.2. So right now it's not compatible. So the version of Zen that is added to the kernel is compatible with EC2. However, someone's actually in contact with someone at Amazon in regards to that, and as it stands right now, I think they're trying to get funding to work on that full time. So if that's something that interests you, then there's people that you'd be willing to work on.
Can you say a couple words about the Grand Central speech?
Say that again.
About
GCDB. Mm-hmm.
Just in general.
Oh, that doesn't work. I actually have not looked at the GCD code, so I sort of have a general idea, but I could basically just regurgitate the Apple web page to you. So you know, it's all singing and all dancing, it makes your code much better. But that's all I can tell you.
How much stuff in FreeBSD 8 was funded by the FreeBSD Foundation for, say, going out and paying somebody to work on for particular projects, as opposed to going to the regular day job and whatever it is they did?
The virtual network stack.
Yeah. I would say that of the things I've talked about today, less than 10%? Maybe 10%.
Veeam is the main safe surprise removal of disks. That was
the
panic.
You
unmounted this for
the tape
when you did unmount.
But the USB stack rewrite was completely unfunded.
Yeah.
The foundation doesn't have, you know, the kind of money to do that. A lot of what has gotten done recently actually has been the ability of developers to connect with companies that had done this. So the MIPS stuff comes from a company that had done a MIPS port. And then people who were interested in MIPS said, you know, do you need this? If you don't need it, can we have it? If we can have it, can we use it? And it's interesting, the foundation gets involved in a lot of that, but that's not directly like saying, you know, I'm going to give John a bunch of money to work 6 months on this thing. It's more, we have a lawyer who can talk to the lawyer at, you know, company X because we're not lawyers. And that's a lot of what the foundation does. They're really greasing the wheels.
I'd seen that they made a post recently saying that they were going to be
high availability.
Yeah. Project.
Yeah.
And they had done, you know, some work in the past with.
It's Pubble. Yeah.
So I wasn't sure what, you know, what the interaction with that really was.
I'd say more things get funded by people either going and working at a company or contracting for a company, like D-Trace, for instance, the original D-Trace stuff. Was done by someone under contract to another to a company, not to the foundation. Some of the bigger types of work just require like one or two people not doing anything else. I can tell you, having looked at the D-Trace code, it requires one or two people not doing anything else. I'm trying to think of how many of these foundations funded Carol.
It's not really. They have some information on their website, but it'd be kind of interesting to see if they could.
They usually say when they funded a project because they're pretty. You know, they bought a trust fund and took the money and did this.
Well, they're slowly ramping up too. Like they, for a while, most of what they funded was things like developer travel and conferences, and they've recently started doing a thing of soliciting proposals and kind of doing more proposals. So I think they've had like three or four in the past year. There's a guy working on one of the guys working on the ABR32 port.
In
the foundation contract, because the guy looking at making
our bug
database much more usable, things like that.
Yeah, some infrastructure
work in this one. The other one was called
the stands
that they spent money on, and those are available on the website.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.